Welcome everyone to the second to last event that we have from our ODI day, which started at about 8 o'clock this morning. So it's been a wonderful day featuring a lot of ODI's experts. And this is the last formal session that we have. And we hope that you all will join us at a reception afterwards, where we're also going to talk about ODI's fellowship scheme, which has existed for 60 years, and including Ed Mountfield, who I'll introduce in just a few minutes. The title of this event is Financing Resilient Prosperity in Small Island Developing States. It's a critically important topic. It's one that I'm passionate about. I started my career in the Foreign Service in the Dominican Republic, where I covered the Caribbean. And I was a Caribbean studies major in college. I think my colleagues at ODI don't realize that. So I cut my teeth doing work in small island developing states. I'm very passionate about the needs of them. And yesterday I was lucky enough to attend a session with Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, who had made some excellent points. And these are some of the things that we'll cover, including talking about how the type of financing that's being offered to the small island developing states just isn't cutting it. And we need to figure this out, for example, saying that 15-year variable financing just doesn't work. And why pay lawyers millions of dollars to help countries renegotiate debt when you could have just provided lower interest rates at longer tenors in the first place? There's a lot that resonates with me. And SIDS are at a critical juncture right now. They face a volatile world economy, geopolitical tensions driving up the cost of imports and disrupting supply chains, a worsening climate crisis, all kinds of issues that are disproportionately affecting the SIDS. And many of these countries have had persistently high debt levels over the last two decades or more. And many of them aren't even considered low-income countries, or even lower middle-income countries, or even upper middle-income countries. One of the challenges we faced when I was at Development Finance Corporation was that we couldn't provide financing in many of the SIDS because many of them are high-income countries for a variety of reasons. That's where they fall under. So it even makes it challenging for some agencies, institutions can't provide the financing that they need. It's not even just not on the right terms. The current debt architecture is not working for the SIDS. And the question is, how do we break this cycle of debt in small islands? This is going to be the critical question that we have at the World Bank Spring Meeting. So more generally, looking forward to the fourth international conference on small island developing states that's happening in May in Barbuda. The SIDS 4 is expected to come up with a 10-year agenda to help small islands find solutions to a range of development challenges that could soon become intractable. At today's event, I hope that we can move beyond restarting the problem, restating the problem, and instead focus on identifying those concrete actions that need to be taken. And I am delighted to say that we have a brilliant group of people to lead this conversation here. So with that, I'm going to introduce Ed Mountfield, who is the Vice President of Operations, Policy, and Country Services at the World Bank, and also a former ODI fellow. Mr. Mountfield works across all regions on the programming, coordination, and delivery of the bank's country services, including project and program financing in advisory services and analytics. Welcome.
Thanks, Andy, first of all, for a great overview of the challenges of SIDS and the discussion today, and also good afternoon to distinguished guests and colleagues. And I want to extend a special welcome to His Excellency Olavo Correa, who's Deputy Prime Minister of Cabo Verde, and Minister Correa co-chairs the World Bank Small States Forum, and he's a valued friend and advisor to us on a wide range of issues. So looking forward to hearing from him. Geography and socioeconomic conditions make SIDS extremely vulnerable to shocks. And this acute vulnerability of SIDS to shocks, be it from natural disasters or economic shocks, is now accentuated by the existential challenge of climate change. And it requires our undivided attention and coordinated action. More than 70% of SIDS are highly susceptible to climate hazards. For example, the frequency of natural disasters experienced by SIDS has quadrupled in the most recent 15 years compared to the same period in the 1960s. Many SIDS also have limited capacity to adapt and respond effectively to these shocks. So calls for the international community to enhance support for SIDS have rightly been intensifying. And as the World Bank Group evolves, we are responding. And I would like to just take this opportunity to highlight some of the ways in which we're helping SIDS meet the challenges that they face, even as we all need to do so much more. And I'll highlight three ways. First, our support for small states, 70% of which are small island developing states, has significantly increased from around $2 billion in our portfolio in 2019 to around $5 billion today. And it's not just about the volume of our support. SIDS have access to our funds on terms that account for their vulnerability and not just their income levels. So for example, IDA, the International Development Association, our concessional financing arm, recognizes the vulnerability of small states, and it makes special provisions related to access volumes and financing terms. And those include the so-called Small Island Economy Exception Policy, the IDA Small Economy Terms Policy, as well as access to the Fragility, Conflict and Violence Envelope and the Crisis Response Window. And since 1985, IDA's Small Island Economy Exception has allowed SIDS access to some of our most affordable funds on the best terms, including grants and even at income levels that would normally make them ineligible for IDA finance. And further, IBRD, the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the bank's non-concessional lending arm, also provides the most favorable lending terms to small states. Second, we're sharpening our focus on crisis preparedness and response. One step we've taken recently is to introduce climate resilient debt clauses, also known as CRDCs, and that's an important milestone in our support. It allows small states, including SIDS, to defer debt payments during disasters so that they can focus on things that matter, such as providing clean water, food, and medicines. And CRDCs cover all our existing loans in eligible countries that sign up to these terms and not just to new loans, so allowing countries to pause interest and principal repayment. And then in addition to this, we recently introduced a new crisis toolkit, which will help all countries, including small states, to better respond to crises and to build lasting resilience. And the toolkit offers a new rapid response option that allows governments to quickly repurpose up to 10% of undisbursed balances in their existing IBRD or IDA portfolio when a crisis strikes, so that they can use these funds for rapid crisis response. And as part of this, we're also offering countries new options to embed catastrophe bonds, parametric insurance, and other risk management products into our financing operations. And governments can then be eligible for a payout in the event of a large crisis without taking on more debt, which is a very important piece of the puzzle. And finally, we're expanding our knowledge work with a dedicated focus on climate resilience of small island developing states. And in the last few years, the World Bank Group has introduced a new analytical product called a Country Climate and Development Report. We're doing these country by country in all of our client countries. And these work to diagnose the challenges in the country from a climate mitigation, but also a climate adaptation point of view. And so we've published the first CCDRs, Country Climate and Development Reports, for the Dominican Republic. And we are now working on two regional CCDRs, one for the Eastern Caribbean and one for the Pacific Atoll countries. These reports are going to assist countries in identifying and prioritizing investments and policy interventions in the most impactful ways, while also focusing on broader development goals. So to conclude, I want to reaffirm the World Bank's steadfast dedication to working in partnership with small island developing states, and gatherings like this one today are invaluable. So I want to again thank ODI and the Commonwealth Secretariat for hosting us. And thanks again to you all for being here, and looking forward to a good discussion.
Thanks so much, Ed. It's great to hear what the bank's doing. It brings me back to my time in the early 2000s when I was serving in the Caribbean, and hurricanes passed through year after year after year. And I watched how all of the agencies struggled to quickly reprogram money. And so we came up then with a crisis modifier clause. We put in all of the legal agreements that allowed us to quickly reprogram. And the other thing, and we'll talk about this and a little bit more, is I watched how the large regional banks sat on excess liquidity every time a hurricane passed through, because their clients were big construction companies and hotels that all had insurance. But the smaller financial institutions had to run on all their capital, because those were the people who had small businesses and homes that needed to rebuild more and more. And we always debated, could we create some sort of standby facility to move the liquidity from the large regional banks to the smaller banks quickly, knowing that that happens. That's a common issue that you also see in the Pacific Islands. So looking forward to the discussion on this. We'd like now like to welcome His Excellency Olavo Correa, the Deputy Prime Minister of Cabo Verde. As many of you know, Cabo Verde is an island nation off the west coast of Africa, and its experiences with environmental and climate shocks, but also debt, are very relevant for the discussions we're having today. I'd now like to invite His Excellency to give some opening remarks, which will help us understand the importance of this issue.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. Let me speak Portuguese. My team can translate it. Muito obrigado, Senhor Presidente da Associação. Senhor Vice-Presidente do Banco Mundial, Montefiels, pelo discurso de abertura sobre os desafios enfrentados pelos CIDs e as mudanças e esforços que o Banco Mundial está a desenvolver, tendo em conta os pequenos estados insulares. Obrigado a todos aqui presentes, e será sem dúvida uma sessão muito esclarecedora.
Thank you, Mr. Montefiels, for your excellent opening remarks and the challenges faced by CIDs and the changes that the World Bank is making to better support us. And thank you to everyone who has attended today for what will be, no doubt, an insightful session.
Estamos a tratar de uma urgência à escala global. E esta urgência ganha uma importância ainda mais acrescida nos pequenos estados e nos pequenos estados solares. Estamos a falar da ação climática e da gestão do clima.
The focus of this session on financing resilient prosperity in CIDs is both appropriate and timely. Many of CIDs countries, including my own, have an urgent need to fortify the defenses against the incredible risks posed by climate change, unsustainable debt, poverty, and inequality. As we know, these risks are connected with devastating consequences for our people and economies.
Durante esta sessão, colocar-nos-emos seguramente questões que irão moldar o nosso futuro e o futuro do mundo. Como podem os pequenos estados insulares e os pequenos estados quebrar o ciclo de forte endividamento que retira recursos a fontes vitais de despesa pública, como a resposta a choques, atenuação e desenvolvimento do capital humano, e que abordagens também inovadoras e relevantes podemos desenvolver por forma a que os CIDs possam investir não só para fazer face às emergências, mas para garantir o desenvolvimento do país.
During this session, we will ask ourselves questions that will shape our future. How CIDs can break the cycle of heavy indebtedness that takes resources away from vital sources of government spending like shock response, mitigation, and human capital development. What innovative approaches are most relevant for CEATS?
A tendência de pensar em inovações como sendo tecnológicas ou científicas, mas muitas das grandes descobertas resultam de trabalho conjunto em parceria, onde novos pensamentos e formas de fazer as coisas são forjadas, são criadas. As inovações de que necessitamos para dar o pontapé de saída para a mudança assumem muitas formas, muitas vezes com elementos que são simultaneamente financeiros, mas sobretudo de colaboração e parceria e de governança. E permitam-me partilhar convosco um exemplo recente de inovação financeira no meu próprio país, Cabo Verde.
We tend to think of innovation as technological or scientific, but many of great breakthroughs come from working with others in new and better ways. The innovations we need to kickstart change take many forms, often with elements that are both financial and collaborative. Let me share with you a recent example of financial innovation from my own country.
No ano passado, Cabo Verde assinou acordo com Portugal para trocar a nossa dívida, que é passivo nacional, por investimentos no futuro ambiental e climático que estamos a criar, que é ativo global. Ou seja, nós procuramos converter passivo, que é passivo com excedência local, para ativo que tem implicância global, que é o clima. Este acordo de troca de dívida por natureza pode constituir modelo muito útil para os outros países, pequenos estados insulares em desenvolvimento, mas também para muitos credores que têm créditos para com os pequenos estados insulares e que procuram também, os pequenos estados insulares, melhorar a sustentabilidade da dívida e, ao mesmo tempo, dar resposta às alterações climáticas. Esta abordagem também demonstra o valor e a importância de trabalhar em colaboração e em parceria e no quadro da boa governança, mas, sobretudo, em parceria com outros países nos planos bilaterais ou multilaterais, mas também em parceria com as instituições financeiras internacionais.
Last year, Cabo Verde signed an agreement with Portugal to swap our debt for investments in an environmental and climate fund that we are establishing. This debt for nation swap deal may provide a helpful model for other cities seeking to improve debt sustainability while responding to climate change. This approach also demonstrates the value of working collaboratively with other countries and IFIs.
O financiamento em condições preferenciais e concessionais para os CEATS deve e pode ser melhorado com sentido de urgência. Agradecemos aqui o empenho do Banco Mundial e de outros parceiros de desenvolvimento em conceder financiamentos mais adequados às nossas necessidades, nomeadamente em matéria de adaptação e atenuação das alterações climáticas, mas também no que tange à resiliência, respostas às crises, mas também no que tange à redução da dívida. Os progressos devem, no entanto, ser apoiados por reformas sólidas nos planos internos, mecanismos justos de partilha de encargos, responsabilização e atenção especial e particular aos mais vulneráveis numa lógica de inclusão social, mas também de género.
Concessional financing from CEATS should and can be improved. We appreciate the World Bank's and other development partners' commitment to providing financing that is better tailored to our needs, especially climate adaptation and mitigation, crisis response, and debt reduction. Progress must, though, be underpinned by strong reforms, fair burden sharing mechanism, accountability, and special attention to the most vulnerable.
Essencialmente, esta sessão examinará formas de fazer mais com mais, ou seja, como podemos obter financiamento e reduzir a dívida. Como podemos ser mais resistentes aos choques, ao mesmo tempo, sermos mais inclusivos. Como unirmos para juntos partilhar novas ideias e criar parcerias e colocar esses ativos ao serviço dos nossos jovens e das nossas mulheres.
In essence, the session will explore ways that we can do more with more. How we can raise financing and reduce debt. How we can make ourselves more resilient to shock and be inclusive as well. And how we can come together to share new ideas and build partnerships.
Por isso, aguardo com expectativa o que seremos capazes de fazer em conjunto nos próximos tempos e com sentido de urgência.
I look forward to what is to come. And I look forward to working together with urgency.
Okay. E neste contexto, permitam-me passar a palavra então à produtora Sarah Hovard, que partilhará connosco um documentário revelador. A todos vós, o nosso muito obrigado.
On that note, let me pass over to Ms. Sarah Howard, who will share with us an eye-opening documentary. Thank you very much.
Hello, everyone. I'm Sarah Howard. I am the director and co-producer of Climate Blueprint Dominica, which you're about to see. I want to start off by acknowledging my co-producer, Emily Wilkinson, who sadly could not be with us, but who you will see in the film. So this story is about a quest to be the first climate resilient nation in the world. And it's truly a whole of society, whole of government approach to resilience and adaptation. So why a film? We felt that it was important and powerful to have a place-based, people-focused story of what the many reports and studies say. You know, something that is beyond just the numbers. As has been mentioned already, SIDS have a high debt burdens, and understanding why that is a critical part of being able to address that pressure. So this film is meant to highlight what that debt pressure is and how it's significantly impacted by external shocks, things like climate change and extreme weather, rather than a question of governance or management. In fact, in the case of Dominica, you'll see that they have a clearly defined, comprehensive, and target-based plan for resilience. Later in the session, you get to hear from Gail with more details on exactly what those challenges look like in the SIDS community. But for example, in Dominica, lost 226% of GDP after Hurricane Maria. So these numbers are significant. They can be at the same time faceless and impersonal. So this film is meant to bring a more humanized approach to these numbers and demonstrate the powerful sense of agency in places like Dominica and why that needs to be supported. Ultimately, this film is making a case for why SIDS need special treatment from IFIs. So if you have any questions about the film, please come and find me afterwards. And bear with us for a moment. We have a little bit of a technical setup before the film will play. So I hope you enjoy.
I come to you straight from the front line of the war on climate change. With physical and emotional difficulty, I have left my bleeding nation to be with you here today because these are the moments for which the United Nations exist. We as a country and as a region did not start this war against nature. We did not provoke it. The war has come to us. We are in shock, but we will rise. Because Dominican people are strong, because Caribbean people are resilient.
Maria is the worst I've ever seen. It's something not to forget. We were in town that morning, and then we heard there was this storm coming in. Everybody went shopping and make sure we have drinking water, enough food to sustain that hurricane. Making sure we have everything inside, putting our animals and make sure everything is stable. 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, the hurricane arrived in our area. We heard a whistling sound. I was in my basement and I was hearing like trees falling. The houses were all flying away. Like there was this the ground, it shook like an earthquake. Next morning, My God, no houses. All the houses were gone. At one point in time, I said to myself, what are we going to do?
Hits a country like Dominica, it affects the entire country. How does a country like Dominica recover from that? And how does a country like Dominica respond? There's no blueprint that we could pick up and follow for a resilient nation. So we had to create for ourselves our vision of resiliency. This is us trying to come to a solution for ourselves and looked at what are the key areas that we need to be focusing on. Building strong communities, a robust economy, a well-planned and durable infrastructure, collective consciousness, sustainably leveraged natural resources, and institutionalizing resilience. When the vision was expressed to make us a climate-resilient country, I think there was a buy-in by the whole population with, yes, we need to be doing this.
Dominica set out to become the world's first climate resilient nation. That is incredibly ambitious, but the ambition is important. It sets a goal. It's an example of a country that's fighting back. Dominica's not unique in trying to formulate a plan and implement a plan to address these issues. All small island developing states around the world are taking this seriously because they have to. Dominica may be further along in really articulating the vision and setting really clear targets and developing indicators to measure progress on the things that the country's committed to doing. The whole world is going to have to do this. The sense of small islands as being the canary in the coal mine, they're the first to experience what everybody else is going to have to deal with. None of this can happen overnight. There is no silver bullet. There's no quick fix to dealing with climate change in the tropics. But they're definitely moving in the right direction.
We are the niche island in the Caribbean. We have lots of rivers, mountains, valleys.
Dominica is beautiful. Dominica is good.
It's a word to describe it.
Dominican people, they are hardworking.
We help each other. We go the extra mile.
The people are involved in their community.
Everybody in Dominica is friendly.
Very loving people.
The people are resilient. We're able to bounce back quickly.
About 500 years ago, we the Tallinago people lived in the entire Caribbean. All that changed when Columbus came into the Caribbean.
With colonization, things changed completely, particularly when the British took over Dominica. Sugar was a big product of the day. Every European power wanted a sugar island. Britain had got this one, and so it was surveyed and subdivided for sugar. After emancipation, enslaved people who had formerly lived on the plantations were told basically that if you don't continue to work for us, you've got to get off. So what happened in the East was that along the plantation boundaries, you found the rugged land that the plantation didn't need. And so the people who had previously been living on the plantations then moved to these rugged areas. So you have villages which are seriously affected today because they are sitting on areas which are very volatile when it comes to rainstorms.
Without being deterministic about history, you can trace all of these things back to decisions and actions that happened a very long time ago. During the colonial period, the assumption was that it would be the local plantation owners that would invest in infrastructure, and they didn't.
An important part of the work that CREED has been doing is looking at how we can institutionalize resilience, ensuring that government's agenda is fully aligned with the climate resilience plan so that you have a country that can better weather climate-related disasters and other disasters and be able to bounce back or bounce forward much better.
That kind of mainstreaming resilience across governments was really a critical component of what CREED was set up to do, to really get the sort of resilience thinking and awareness of climate change and hazards into the psyche of the people and of the government. And they're going to need to make sure that everything they do is measured and link it back to projects, that there's really understanding of resilience, what it means, how to measure progress on it, and supporting government as well in understanding better what they're doing to contribute to the resilience goal of the country. It can't be just like one agency or one government department or one initiative that addresses all of that, because it's about everything. It's about agriculture, it's about housing, it's about roads, and in Dominica, critically, bridges, where things are located in relation to slopes, in relation to rivers, in relation to the sea. It's about education and people growing up understanding that and wanting to kind of participate in this kind of transformational vision. You can see that it really involves sort of everybody. The Climate Resilience and Recovery Plan, there's 20 targets that Dominica wants to achieve by 2030. One of the most critical ones refers to the ability of communities to be self-reliant after an extreme weather event. The target is for 14 days. So if you think about what that implies and what's needed in a community for it to be able to self-subsist for 14 days after a hurricane, that's quite a number of things. It's how can government and businesses and through supply chains, how can we ensure that communities are set up to deal with these things on their own?
We did trainings with the Office of Disaster Management. We have teams that we call CERT. So it's Community Emergency Response Team.
We do simulations in case that happen, how are we going to respond? It's about letting people take ownership of where they are and teach people to trust each other and to trust the process.
A strong community is the backbone of resilience. And if your communities are strong and are prepared, then you can recover much more quickly.
Cooperative action is very relevant because a disaster happens, you're cut off from the rest of the island. It usually is extremely difficult for government services to reach you. There's a lot of cooperation, so much so that there's a type of cooperation called coup de main in the Creole, which means a helping hand.
After Maria, there is this one community called Wainika. 4 days after the hurricane, all of these individuals within that community were back in their homes because they were carpenters, they were plumbers, they were electricians that help. Anything that has to be done, we would reach out to each other.
When the French settlers arrived, they transformed the indigenous houses into more European-style oblong houses with roofs and windows and all that kind of stuff. But they maintained some of the qualities of the indigenous. and they were extremely resilient to hurricanes. Not only was it a matter of the design of the house, but also the placement of the house. Many, a number of them, have been there for 200 and something, 250 years, and they've withstood hurricanes for that length of time. But then in the 1950s, we sacrificed all of that. There was this fixation about copying the United States. We brought in a whole set of imported stuff, prefabricated glass windows. There were never glass windows before. You need houses that are well ventilated, that adapt to the northeast trade winds that constantly come from the east. And yet at the same time, within a short period of time, I'm talking about minutes, can be shut up and be secure. This is the classic Dominica teakai. You have got a bonnet roof, or what they call a half hip. Across there, you peg it all in. It holds that end of the roof together. It prevents the roof from being ripped off. A flat roof takes off more quickly and easily than if you have a steeper roof, which is well braced and framed, you know. So all of these elements are important when you're considering resilience.
Climate change is real, eh? We're experiencing it every year. We have been exposed to some element, whether it's intense rainfall, hurricanes, flooding, drought. We cannot keep going back to ground zero, starting all over every time a storm like Maria or Erica happens. We have seen intense rain in short period with a lot of water. The soil that we have can absorb a lot of that water, and that can itself cause a lot of land slippage.
Our number one plan to try to stop it would be to control the underlying water, water that you don't see. Like make provision that when it rains, that it would follow a system of drains. A water catchment would lead straight towards the sea, so it doesn't affect any of the soil around it. The other option would be to implement our vective air systems, where we use for soil stabilization.
So if you notice on this plot of land, the farmer has a step drain that will reduce the speed at which the water will run off the slope, as well as there are some counter drains to cut back on the water that will be going down the slope. So there are some of the things that you would put in place, and that's to do with the intense rain. We have to go back to what we used to do before, because in the past, farmers used green solutions as part of their sustainable practice on their farm.
We are brilliant minds, and we have some good people, you know, behind these said projects. So I believe if we put our mind to it and, you know, we actually challenge it back.
It's about having a strong economy and high-end exports. It produces bay oil and other essential oils, which can sell for higher prices. So you've got to get organized and kind of invest in that agro-processing. It's not just about diversification, it's about specialization.
We all get together, we can create more honey, you know?
That is a great hope.
Dominica is a volcanic country. We have significant geothermal resources, and this is an area that we are pursuing for development because we think that this can spur our green industrialization. We believe that we have sufficient resources that would allow us to be able to build a plant that can provide green hydrogen that can be made available for export to other countries. And of course, there are spin-off businesses that can come as utilizing the byproducts. That creates a huge opportunity for our people to transform our economy.
When we speak of resilience, we speak of the shared knowledge we gather from our elders, and we young people have to do things so that the children of us will benefit from it.
People think about strong walls and strong houses, but strong people, strong children, strong homes, all of that matter. So resilience is let every day be better than the day before, because something yesterday made you stronger for today. Learning through your tribulations so that you might be a strength to somebody who might go through something similar. And if you could make it, I can make it too. So walk with me for a little while. That's it, not just for yourself, but for others.
What I do remember is the beauty of the reefs. In the 50s, we adopted the banana industry. All the banana fields had to be sprayed. That was a massive amount of chemical poison that was poured into the island. That all then flowed down onto these reefs. And now the reefs are dead. That caused a serious issue, because then the reefs were not able to protect an island coast against the storm surge. When you go down to the southern end of the island, in the area where there's a Soufrière Marine Reserve, that did not have the banana industry. And the reefs down there are pretty healthy.
Here at Nature Island Diving, we've sort of changed our business model a little bit, where our dive masters are actually utilizing that time that we have during dives with tourists to actually do a conservation project. A lot of these zones that we have set up here, these are all standard parts of the Soufrière Scottshead Marine Reserve. This is an area where we'd like to do an underwater statue park, also put a wreck and put more parking. The sort of idea is make Champagne an even bigger attraction area where people would have lots of different activities to do. What we've been doing is sort of cutting edge, especially where you're getting tourism to work with conservation. My hope for the future, it's not very grandiose. It's not trying to save the world, change anything massive like that. It's just, I hope that Soufrière Scottshead Galleon can reach the full potential that I believe this community has.
Dominica has not sat back and said, you know, we're vulnerable, we're a victim. We have developed a solution for ourselves. If Dominica can show that it is a good example for others to follow, so that all of us can become more resilient, all of us can reduce the impact of these disasters on our countries. There are opportunities available for the world to participate in the transformational vision of a small country seeking to become a climate resilient country. And one is in relation to the accessibility of climate finance. It's very difficult for small states to access because the procedures that are in place are quite onerous and take a lot of time.
All of the targets have all been generated here in Dominica. It wasn't written by external consultants. So for donors and for development partners, this should be seen as an opportunity. Somewhere where they can support that vision because it already exists. It's really a partnership. This is not a question of charity. There is a real moral and economic imperative. All of the benefits that the UK reaped from industrializing, developing, extracting natural resources from countries like Dominica have in some way contributed to climate change. There's a kind of double responsibility for helping to support Dominica in its resilience journey. These are questions of climate justice. The message is we're already doing a lot and people are investing their own resources in building resilience. And that needs to be supported. There's enough kind of collective knowledge of what needs to be done to get on with it.
The time has come for the international community to make a stand and to decide whether it will be shoulder to shoulder with those suffering the ravages of climate change worldwide, or whether the international community will merely show some pity now and then flee, relieved to know that this time it was not you. Above all else, Mr. President, and members of this august body, we need you. We need your humanity, and we need you now to act truly as our United Nations.
Powerful film. I can't tell you enough how much Emily Wilkinson wishes that she could be here right now. And we wish she could be here as well. I think that Sarah was being a little bit humble when she was talking about the film, didn't mention the fact that it actually won the best short documentary at the Albany Film Festival. And it's been nominated for many other awards as well, but it really hits home for me. And it's interesting for me to watch this because it brings together a lot of the things that ODI does beyond these types of gatherings, including our fellowship scheme, which we'll celebrate in about 30 minutes. But we have a whole series of fellows who are embedded within ministries in small island developing states all over the world. And then in seeing the disaster response teams, we also are running a program called Tandem, which trains local and national disaster response teams and humanitarian response teams on leadership skills. So we're really pleased to be able to contribute to this in many ways, but there's obviously so much more that we can do. I'm going to turn the microphone over now to Gail Hurley, who is the head of Resilient and Sustainable Islands Initiative, RESI. She's also the co-author of a new report, and she's going to present some of the key findings and recommendations from the report. So once we've heard from Ms. Hurley, I'll then invite some experts from the international finance institutions to comment on these findings. I'd like to invite the other panelists to retire. I know that you've given us a lot of your time, if you need to go. And so you're welcome to stay as well. But thank you so much. Okay, and we'll bring the panelists up now. Okay, so let's do that. Why don't we bring up the other panelists? Thank you. Yeah, please do. Oh, good, you're staying. Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm watching.
Okay. You're not going to put down you're going to need your report. So we'll go ahead and invite the panelists up right now. I'm not sure if everyone is here because I don't know everyone. So I'm hoping you're here. So we'll do it. Well, they can come up and have the conversation. So I'd like to invite Manuela Francisco, who's a global director of macroeconomics, trade and investment at the World Bank. Yes, I know that you're here. Mark Flanagan, who's a deputy director of the strategy, policy and review department at the IMF. Thank you. And Henry Mooney is an economics advisor at the Inter-American Development Bank. And everyone's here. We're in business. Let me get out of your chairs. Oh, you have chairs. Excellent. Okay, I will now turn it over to Gail.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Andy. And thank you, Sarah and Emily, for such an amazing film and an inspiring film, I think, one with a really powerful and positive message. I'm really pleased to be here today. Just by way of clarification, I'm not head of RESI, but thank you anyway. I am one of the report co-authors. So Emily Wilkinson is also a report co-author. She is one of the directors of RESI. For those of you that don't know, RESI stands for Resilient and Sustainable Islands Initiative, which is a think tank specifically focused on SIDS, sitting within ODI. I'd like to acknowledge all my co-authors to the report entitled Breaking the Cycle of Debt, What New Options Exist for SIDS. The main report is accompanied by six country case studies, which look in a little bit more detail at their debt journeys. One of those is Cabo Verde, I'm pleased to say. And what we do with this work is look at the evidence to understand what is working and what is not when it comes to strategies and tools to manage debt, and then crucially consider what new options exist and what recommendations can we make to do things better and differently. So we've produced this work ahead of the SIDS 4 conference next month in Antigua and Barbuda, in the expectation that it will provide policymakers at both national and international levels with fresh ideas on how to support SIDS to achieve resilient prosperity while maintaining debt at sustainable levels. So the other country case studies that we looked at, in addition to Cabo Verde, you see them on the slide here. In the Caribbean, they are Antigua and Barbuda and Jamaica. And in the Pacific, we looked at Fiji, Solomon Islands, and Tonga. So what did we find? So overall, the picture is very mixed when it comes to debt in SIDS as a whole, but it's clear for many, and was emphasized by Andy in his opening remarks, that debt is a persistent and unresolved issue for many SIDS, and indeed the issue also featured very prominently at the SIDS 3 conference in Samoa a decade ago. There is an undisputed link between high debt and shocks. And we see that increases in debt, large increases in debt, have been especially pronounced following, in particular, natural disaster and climate-related shocks. There's also the recent COVID-19 pandemic we can throw into the mix there. So SIDS talk about what we can call the compounded impacts of several shocks in rapid succession. So before they've had a chance to recover from a previous shock, another shock strikes, which leads to very rapid and large increases in public debt. We also, back please. Thanks. We also see that the creditor profile for many SIDS has shifted significantly over recent years. And this is really important point because in our view, there's no question that this has accentuated debt vulnerabilities in SIDS. So there's been a shift away from bilateral debt owed to the more traditional Paris Club creditors towards other bilateral lenders, particularly China, which is now the most important lender for some SIDS. Multilateral debt has increased significantly for many, and there have been large increases in domestic debt, which across SIDS as a whole now represents over half of public debt. And that debt can be more expensive and carry shorter maturities, accentuating refinancing risks. And I think the key question that we raise in the report is whether this shift is appropriate, and in particular, a shift to non-concessional, less affordable forms of debt is really the right mix and the most appropriate form of financing for SIDS given their structural vulnerabilities. And of course, with higher levels of debt as a whole, we also see a very large increase in debt service levels, in some cases to really extraordinary levels when measured as a percent of revenues. I know the figure here is a little bit difficult to see, but I can point out a few of the more striking numbers. So there's 30 SIDS that we looked at. Six spent more than 60% of revenues on debt service. A further seven spent more than 30% of revenues on public debt service in 2023. And by way of comparison, the heavily indebted poor countries initiative targeted a ratio of debt service spending of no more than 15 to 20% to ensure that sufficient revenues are available for pro-poor expenditure. So you can see a lot of SIDS are well above that, in some cases significantly above that. Only 12 of the SIDS out of 30 are below that target ratio. And I think the key point we make in the report is that debt service levels this high are fundamentally incompatible with building the climate resilient, climate friendly, high skill economies of the future that SIDS want to see. And as just was portrayed in the video there on Dominica. And that looking forward, our debt levels are projected to remain extremely high between now and 2030. So limiting many SIDS capacities to invest in the sustainable development goals. So that's sort of the bigger picture where we stand. But we wanted to look at actually what has been working, what have SIDS and the international community been doing that has been helping them out and making a difference. So we looked at the successes. So I'm going to focus mostly on what the six, next slide, please. I'm going to focus mostly on what the six country case studies are telling us here. And I'll also start by saying that there is a lot positive out there. It's not all a doom and gloom story, although it is a very serious issue. But there is a lot that is happening in terms of the actions that are being taken at both country level by domestic governments and by the international community. So in terms of the successes, we see crucially that debt has been well used for the most part. So for example, Cabo Verde, we just heard from the Deputy Prime Minister there, it has used concessional loans to finance major improvements in its transportation infrastructure, which has had a really important impact on bolstering its tourism economy there. In Antigua and Barbuda, loans also to finance key infrastructure investments in housing and transportation, as well as to sponsor recovery from hurricanes Maria and Irma in 2017. Tonga also used debt well to finance recovery from its recent catastrophic volcanic eruption. So there's really limited evidence of profligacy, so to speak. And so the SIDS country case studies all emphasized that in financing these critical investments, what is really important is accessing financing on concessional, affordable terms to be able to realize those gains in development. Secondly, that reductions in debt are possible. Jamaica, in particular, from across the case studies, has been touted as the poster child of debt reduction. It's been on a remarkable debt reduction journey over the last decade, lowering its debt from over 135% of GDP in 2013 to a projected 72% a decade later in 2023. Cabo Verde also seen large reductions in debt over the last couple of years. So what contributed to those successes? So some of the factors that those countries cited as important were things like fiscal responsibility, legislation, access to concessional finance and limits on non-concessional borrowing being in place. But I think crucially and most importantly, evidence, particularly from Jamaica, suggests that strong public support and civic engagement on debt issues can also help to support debt sustainability and enhance oversight. So CID's making many efforts to strengthen tax revenues, implement various fiscal reform measures in various ways that we talk about in the report. The Deputy Prime Minister of Cabo Verde talked about their recent innovation, innovative debt swap in Cabo Verde. So we see that several CIDs have made use of innovative debt instruments to reduce debt or to mobilize new capital more cheaply, and that some CIDs have been playing a leading role in this area. So debt for climate swaps in Barbados and Belize are examples also. I think, Henry, you've been involved in some of those and can maybe speak to those in more detail. Fiji has also issued on concessional terms new blue bonds and green bonds recently. Jamaica's catastrophe bond is another example. And then finally, I think it's fair to say, and as probably our panelists will emphasize as well, I imagine, that the international community has stepped up its responsiveness to CIDs over recent years, and it does now offer a larger and more tailored range of mechanisms to support CIDs to deal with emergencies and manage debt more effectively. So a colleague from the World Bank talked about CRDCs, a range of new contingent financing facilities has also emerged as well. But there are limitations, of course, to all of this. Next slide, please, Courtney.
I just want to do a time check.
Of course.
We can try to, I know we've been waiting to just try to move quickly as we can. Thank you.
I'll try to be rapid. There's a lot in the report, so I would urge you to go and please take a look at it afterwards when it's published. I think, look, the first point, which is really critical and what I want to emphasize here, is that we see that a significant portion of debt that CIDs are taking on is not being used to advance the development effort, but rather to restore previous development levels in the wake of an emergency or a large shock. So for example, we see that 40% of Tonga's current debt load is in relation to disaster recovery only. So that's a really important point. That makes gains in debt reduction that I was just talking about really fragile because of CID's vulnerability to external shocks. And I think that is problematic because if we consider that those gains in debt reduction have come at a high cost in terms of foregone investments in human capital development and also in terms of foregone investments in infrastructure. CIDs also emphasize that they need access to concessional finance and that there's not enough out there. And this is an issue of climate justice. The shift towards multilateral debt, a lot of CIDs now owe their debt a large share to multilateral lenders. On the surface, that might seem positive because it can carry longer maturities and lower interest rates. But because that debt is exempt from debt restructuring, it could also pose a problem if countries enter into a debt crisis. A lot of countries describe the innovative debt instruments that they've been working with as useful, but hard work, especially for small countries. So definitely interested in Henry's and others' views on that. And a lot of those contingent financing facilities that I was talking about, the emergency response, still create new debt liabilities in the future. And that simple debt deferral mechanisms are unlikely to resolve unsustainable debt situations. Okay, so moving on, I know you want me to speed up. Andy talked about wanting to move from diagnosis to solutions. So there's a lot in the report. And so there's 8 recommendations that we set out that are listed here. The first is a long-standing call from SIDS to integrate vulnerability into determinations of access to concessional finance. We suggest one way in the report of doing that could be to consider SIDS long-term risks of debt distress rather than just consider their debt risks over a short-term time horizon. And that should be used to determine the most appropriate forms of financing for those countries. We need affordable finance at scale. We need scaled up use of climate resilient debt clauses. And so we encourage those lenders that have not yet done so to use this kind of useful instrument, because the larger the number that do it, the more useful it will be. But we also urge the international community to go beyond CRDCs. So there's a tendency to see debt deferral clauses as a solution, but in many cases, actually automatic debt cancellation, say for a period of 3 to 5 years following a large enough disaster, is going to be much more beneficial to countries. So we urge the international community to think about that. More flexibility in debt swaps to maximize their potential. We see there's a lot of enthusiasm for them, but a lot of skepticism as to whether they've actually delivered, whether they're worth the cost. So we make some suggestions in the report about how arrangements can be more made more flexible so that this tool can actually be scaled up. We reiterate our support for a debt sustainability support service that can help SIDS with things like understanding the impact of climate change on public finances, helping SIDS to negotiate the terms of new financing, debt restructuring in a closed door, private, impartial environment being really important. More transparency is needed by both lenders and borrowers. And then obviously we situate this within a context in which we need to make the international debt architecture work for SIDS, and they need a seat at the table in those decisions that will have most influence.
Thank you. And I'm sorry to have to do that, but we're just so pressed for time and everyone's been very, very patient. It's an excellent report. And my understanding is it's going to be released at the SIDS Forum that's going to be taking place in Barbuda, in Antigua and Barbuda this May. So we're going to move on to some reflections from the panelists. So thank you very much. I'm going to turn to our 3 experts for their comments. So Manuel, I'll turn to you first. You've listened to Ms. Hurley's report, and based on the report and your own observations, what do you see as the key macro fiscal risks facing SIDS, and what policy responses should they consider?
Many thanks, and thank you so much for inviting me to be here. I have not read the report, but I will make sure I will. It seems to be a very interesting report, and thank you so much for the message that you shared with us today. So we talked about debt a lot. So I would just like to say briefly a few things about the economic context of these countries, because we tend to forget about that. So small island economies tend to have small markets, and that has lots of implications to attract private sector. They have low economies of scale. They have high fixed costs. The economy tend to be focused in a few sectors, which makes these economies very dependent on what happens to these sectors and not very resilient. They tend to be largely dependent on imports of energy goods, capital goods, and food. In addition to all of this, as we saw in that movie, which was quite moving, I should say, these countries are very vulnerable to climate change. As a result of all this, these countries carry very heavy debt portfolios and with very high costs. So that is a challenge. So just looking into the low-income, small island economies, three out of four of them are at high risk of debt distress or already in distress. Since 2020, none of these countries are at low risk of debt distress. And just to give an indication, and I will talk about average because I understand every economy is a different economy, and there are also the market access economies. But on average, the small island economies right now, the average of debt to GDP is 62%. This is a lot for this kind of economies. These economies are also very vulnerable to shocks. So in the decade before COVID, debt to GDP increased by 4 percentage points. It came the pandemic shock and it went up 13 percentage points in one single year. Things got better and it has come down, is now at the 62% 2023, but is still 5 percentage points above a pre-pandemic. The result of this is that we have debt vulnerabilities, we have lots of uncertainties with what's going to happen with the world, geopolitics, the direction of inflation, the pace and direction of global financial conditions. There are large current account deficits because of the large dependence on imports. And so the countries face themselves with this dual challenge: debt vulnerabilities and climate change. To address climate change, lots of financing is needed, but there is no fiscal space because the countries need to meet their obligations when it comes to debt service. So it's a tricky situation and a very challenging situation. So I thought about how to say and what and some advice, and I'm sure the countries are already thinking about all these things, so I may not say anything new, but I will divide these into a short term and medium term. So first of all, I think given this fiscal position and debt vulnerabilities, it's very important that the countries have access to highly concessional financing. Large inflows of concessional financing. Second, it's very important for some countries to smoothen the debt repayments. Some of them face liquidity situations. So finding a way to smoothen the path by debt reprofiling, by some innovative solutions, debt swaps or other ways to make sure that these countries are not taken all by the debt service, but more can be dedicated to other sectors. And I'm not going to repeat what has been said about that. For these economies to grow, more needs to go into human capital, infrastructure, support private sector development. And third, increase domestic resource mobilization, which is very important for the fiscal needs. In the medium term,
I'm going to also do a time check for you. So we can go through these quickly, please.
So I'm going to be very brief. Build fiscal buffers to increase the resilience. Make spending more counter-cyclical. Strengthen debt management and debt policies. Diversify the economies. Make infrastructure more resilient to climate shocks. And very important, I believe, leverage a regional approach. Thank you.
Thank you. That was incredibly helpful. I'm going to turn to Mark now. Mark, it's in the interest of time, and I apologize. I know we asked you each to speak for a greater amount of time. If you could try to keep your remarks about 3 or 4 minutes, because we're already at time. Thank you.
Okay. I will be very selective.
Thank you.
So first, to thank Gail for the report. I did read through it a couple of times. There's some interesting analysis and some interesting recommendations there. I just want to touch on a couple of the recommendations that you make. Let me first of all state our strong support at the IMF for climate resilient debt clauses. These can play a meaningful role in helping countries. They not only help by freeing up resources for governments to respond to crises, they help by freeing up administrative resources. The last thing a government in a small country wants to do in the middle of a giant crisis is to have to negotiate with creditors. Now, we encourage all creditors to adopt these. A lot of these creditors take comfort in the IMF yet having a role in helping the country respond to the shock and in providing financing actually to that end. So a lot of them don't expect us to have CRDCs. We did look at whether replicating such instruments would make a difference. And we simulated it. And the answer is it makes very little difference for small island developing states if the IMF offers these things, because we're a revolving fund. We don't always have debt service due in a lot of these countries. And we can typically provide much more through our emergency financing facilities. Second point I want to make is about automatic debt relief mechanisms. I think there is a role for these, and I think there will be an increasing role for these going forward. And in fact, I hate to put it this way, but if you get there's a famous debt lawyer, Lee Bukite, who once said, you know, if all debt is super senior, no debt is super senior. So Gail, when you identify the fact that there's a concern about a buildup of multilateral debt, that points in the direction of automatic debt relief mechanism. I think you're right in indicating that the key issue is funding for these sort of instruments. It's institution specific. For the fund, we have such an instrument already, our Catastrophe Containment and Relief Trust. The one thing we find with that is it relies on donor funding, and donors don't like to pre-commit funds. They prefer to give their funding to things that have immediate impact. So if you're talking about, can you contribute to a fund that down the road one day might deliver relief, they're hesitant. Third point I want to make is about the Debt Sustainability Support Service initiative. I mean, we see merits in this. We also see challenges. I mean, there's the coordination challenge, of course, with the existing technical assistance out there. We in the bank do an awful lot of technical assistance on DSA training. African Legal Support Fund does a lot of training and assistance when it comes to restructurings. I think there'd have to be some careful thought about how it fits in. I would caution about this idea I saw in the proposal from the UN about building capacity in these countries and in their universities. These are small states, and you know, a lot of the ministries of finance just don't have the bodies available, literally, to do these things. So the other point I want to make about it is there's a big opportunity to support debt transparency here. If you have watched our website, we've just released a working paper entitled The Legal Foundations of Public Debt Transparency, Aligning the Law with Good Practices. Suffice to say, the practices fall well short of where they should be globally in many countries. And correcting this is not necessarily something that's easy to do, not something that a country has capacity to do, and technical assistance there can be extremely helpful. Final point, comprehensive debt relief by a new HIPC-like mechanism. I wanted to say a word about that. So that's a matter of political choice, right? I mean, we do have an existing system that can deliver relief case by case. The advantage of a framework, obviously, is that it has simplicity and efficiency, and it can go faster just for those reasons. You can calibrate such frameworks to deliver the right amount of relief on average, or to err on the side of making sure that you never fail to provide the right amount of relief. But these things take time to gain political support. I remind everybody about the 90s, how long it took to develop political support for the HIPC initiative. So I would not consider any such initiative imminent. And I don't see the necessary political pressure to actually make it imminent at the moment. So that's how I'd touch on that.
And I'll stop. I like the way that you think. So I really appreciate that. And thank you. I'm going to turn to Henry now. So Henry, same question for you. What do you think? Yeah. What from the report do you think could most benefit from the situation facing the small islands?
Sure. Thanks. So I have 2 pages of very detailed notes, but I'm going to abandon that in the interest of getting it all in 3 or 4 minutes. I think as a Canadian, I can speak fast enough. But listen, thank you, Gail, for this excellent work and your team, Courtney, and everyone. We've had several conversations on these topics. I think it's a great report. I think all 8 of the recommendations are excellent, and I think very worthy and potentially very impactful. Feasibility is perhaps another issue, and I think that there are varying degrees of it, at least at this time, certainly on the resource side with things like debt relief and concessionality, but I think obviously these would be very important. So let me focus on, I had 3 or 4 things to focus on, but I'll focus on just 2, which you mentioned, which are very much in line, I will say, with the IDB's institutional strategy revamping, which is trying to focus on making everything we do aligned with the objective of resilience and helping countries that are vulnerable to climate change, natural disasters, but also in catalyzing new sources of private finance to help alleviate the burden of this kind of investment from the public sectors and put more of it on the private sector through PPPs and other mechanisms when we can. So with that in mind, one thing that has come up and one of the recommendations is more emphasis and resources for debt swaps. I think, you know, as we have discussed before, this is very feasible. The IDB has kind of been leading the way. You mentioned the debt swaps for Barbados. We've been doing others. We're working on a second debt swap for Barbados. I would say that this is really important. It's not sufficient in itself. Obviously, it has to be part of a portfolio of different mechanisms. But one thing that's important here is that it's a liability neutral type of operation. We're talking about, at least in the context of what we have been doing, issuing guarantees, so lending our AAA rating to the governments so that they can swap out higher cost debt for lower cost debt, and then using the savings, that delta, and applying it to particular objectives that are green or sustainable. So I think that that's one thing. These are liability neutral operations, so they don't increase debt, so that makes them very attractive. 2, one of the, as I mentioned before, the institutional reform pillars that our president is trying to move forward, which other MDBs are also trying to move forward, is to try and leverage our balance sheets. This is another way to do that. As you know, a guarantee is not the same as a loan, so the resources required are not the same. And if you have the right accounting treatment, this can actually expand our ability to support countries. Now, that said, it's not a magic bullet. As you said, these are not always straightforward or easy operations. You have to identify a qualifying use of the savings, the funds. So these can be very long-term commitments to, you know, ocean conservation, protecting your coastlines. Point being, it's not as simple as just the savings. You have to be able to deploy the savings in a way over long periods of time, sometimes even decades, that is monitorable and meets the criteria you set out at the beginning, or else you're at the risk of having to pay more, right? There are step-up clauses if you're in terms of the debt, if you're not meeting those criteria. So it's not a silver bullet. It's not a magic bullet. But we see a lot of appetite from our clients. There are a lot more countries asking us to do this than we are able to do. A lot of appetite from the investor community. When we go out with these operations, they're oversubscribed. We're talking to lots of investors. And one, I think, thing here to focus on would be extending the model, right? So debt for nature is one thing, and we're doing operations now that are debt for climate. So for example, in Barbados, the second operation we're doing now, a $300 million guarantee, it's going, the delta, you know, the savings are going to finance infrastructure investment, the kind of investment that a country would have borrowed for greenfield, right? So actually, you can generate a positive flow of investment financing that potentially can increase your productive capacity, the economy's potential, which can then make you more sustainable from a debt perspective. So I won't go on too much, but I think that this is not a magic bullet, but an important one. And I can, in 2 minutes, say something about the other one.
3 to 4.
It
was already 3 to 4.
I was already 3 to 4.
6.
So. I had 6 already. Okay. 30 seconds. I'm gonna echo Mark. I think the institutional support mechanism is important. I think ex ante investing in policies, capacity for debt management, fiscal management, macro management, super important. Also project selection to make sure that you're selecting projects that are resilient. Brings up the adage, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. The IDB, we're doing something like this on the project preparation side. So we're actually launching project preparation facilities to finance, to support governments in terms of creating better projects that are more resilient and financially sustainable, but also, as I mentioned before, that can catalyze new sources of private finance. So taking off of the public balance sheet some of the kinds of investments that used to be on the public balance sheet that were more susceptible to shocks. And I think we're making a lot of headroom that way.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And thank you to all the panelists for being such good sports. I apologize. We had a late start and we had to condense down the remarks, but I encourage everyone to continue the conversations downstairs where we're going to have a reception. I want to thank everyone. I'd like to thank Courtney Lindsay, who helped organize this event, and from the ODI team. I'd like to thank, this is the end of ODI day until we move over to the receptions, but so it's my chance to say thank you to everyone. Our chief executive, Sara Pantoliano, will be greeting everyone downstairs, but has been patiently sitting through the events today. The communications team, everyone from ODI who's put on outstanding series of events. And I hope you'll get a chance to interact with our senior leadership who's in town from London and everybody else who's been participating today. So thank you, everyone. It's been a wonderful day, and thanks for being patient. We appreciate it.